Jeff Janis is out 4 to 6 weeks. Meanwhile, Clay Matthews and Julius Peppers are subject to suspension unless they cooperate with an interview by the NFL. How could the Packers potentially replace these players? We'll ask Nathan Yockey of ProFootballFocus.com. It's all coming up on Railbird Central next. Fans, welcome to Railbird Central at Cheesehead TV. I'm your host, Brian Caravu. We're talking some Packers football this morning. We're talking about the preseason, and we're talking about all sorts of news related to Green Bay Packers players coming out over the past few days. To do that, we have a guest joining us on the phone today.
Expert interview.
We have Nathan Yockey of ProFootballFocus.com joining us once again for another season. Nathan, welcome back. I think this is 6 seasons, if I'm correct.
Good morning, Brian. Happy to be back and happy that it's been so many years that we've been doing this. Looking forward to another one.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you on the show as always. I kind of wish we were talking about maybe better circumstances this morning, but I'd like to ask you a few questions today, Nathan. I think that given the news surrounding Clay Matthews, Julius Peppers, and Jeff Janis, all for many different reasons, I'd like to focus on both the outside linebackers and the wide receivers in this interview. Just in case the Packers are forced to play without them, although admittedly a lot remains to be seen with each of these aforementioned three players. But let's start with the outside linebackers and Dayton Jones and his performance in the Packers' first preseason game playing outside linebacker for the first time with a full offseason to prepare. How did Dayton Jones look against the Browns, Nathan?
Yeah, obviously you don't want any of those situations to be happening, but luckily they're at two of the position groups that the Packers seem to be deepest in. Dayton Jones, I would say, was one of the more impressive defensive players for the Packers in the game, especially as a pass rusher. He had one sack, one hit, two hurries, and that all came on only 10 pass rushes, so that's very good. In the run game, early in the second quarter, there were a couple plays over the course of a series of plays where he was able to in the run game, get inside of a tight end and disrupt the run. And even though none of those three plays ended up with him making the tackle, it still gives the rest of the defensive players more time to get off their block since it's disrupting the running back. So the only downside to Dayton Jones' game is he didn't start the game. That was Jaron Elliott and Nick Perry who did. So a decent number of his good plays were going up against Brown's backups, but still, considering who he was going up against, it was still a good game for him.
Yeah, I thought he was one of the more impressive players on the defensive side of the football for the Packers last week. Next, I'd like to know about Kyler Fackrell, the Packers' fourth-round draft choice, I think it was. He played in his first professional game against the Browns. We know he, of course, had a sack, but how was his entire body of work?
I didn't come away too impressive with Fackrell's first game. First off, with special teams on the opening kickoff, he failed to block his guy, although he was somewhat saved because the guy ended up missing a tackle. But then on the kickoff to start the second half of the game, Fackrell was the one to miss the tackle. So special teams, I wasn't too impressed. Then it was around the middle of the third quarter that he started seeing playing time on defense. He had one uneventful play against the run, and the rest of his snaps all came in pass rushing situations. The sack, of course, was a good thing, but it was also a little more Cody Kessler's fault. He should have gotten the ball out in time or handed the ball off in that situation. But then Fackrell also had a pressure on the previous play where he was held, which was a little bit of Kessler drifting into it, but still a good play out of Fackrell. So I call it an average pass rushing performance, but when it comes so late in the game, you might want to see a little bit more out of it.
Yeah, ultimately it was just his first game in a Packers uniform, so hopefully he just improves from here on out. Nathan, I'm also curious about Laurenti McRae, who made his Packers debut in the first preseason game after signing as a free agent in the offseason. Did he look like he belonged in the Packers rotation at outside linebacker?
At least as a pass rusher, I think he did. Nick Perry just played that first drive, and then from then till the mid third quarter, it was him, Jones, and Elliott all rotating in and out. And it looked like he belonged in that group. In the second quarter, he had a nice hit from a bull rush, as well as a good pressure, an unblocked pressure later in the third quarter. And a little downside to that is the bull rush hit led to roughing the passer. So while it was impressive pass rushing, getting a roughing the passer is never good. In the run game and special teams, he didn't play quite as well. But those were mostly due to just two plays, the one in the run game being one where the running back was able to get into his gap and left it untouched, and then the special teams play where he just had a penalty. So I thought Jones and Perry probably had better games on defense than McRae did, but that's only really due to one or two plays.
To wrap up our talk about the outside linebackers, what did you make of Reggie Gilbert's performance? Because I've quietly been impressed with him since he got an interception at family night. I know you probably didn't grade that, but following that up with the safety in his first game with the Packers, what do you think of Reggie Gilbert?
Probably only a matter of time before we start grading these family games, but we didn't this year. But I thought Gilbert had an okay game. The play with the safety, I think that was mostly all on Kessler. Gilbert was unblocked by design on the play. It's the quarterback's job to beat that unblocked rusher and not run out of the back of the end zone. But outside of that play, Gilbert had a couple of decent plays here and there, one being a pressure. Another being a run stop he had on 3rd and 25, which getting the tackle on a 3rd and long run isn't the most impressive thing, but still better than nothing. So I call it an average performance out of him. Nothing to really consider pushing him up the depth charts, but definitely not a bad performance by any means. And I think it's also worth noting with both Gilbert and Sacrell that by the time that they came into the game, the Packers really started dominating the time of possession. So neither player really had too many snaps, and the Packers probably expected them to play more, given when they were put into the game. But it was just how well the Packers' offense was doing and how good the defense was doing at that time that they just didn't see the field very much.
Hopefully they'll get a little bit more playing time in these next few preseason games. But we're talking to Nathan Yonke of ProFootballFocus.com here at Railbird Central on a Wednesday morning. Nathan, if we switch our attention to the wide receivers, I'd like to talk about some of the guys who could potentially see more playing time in Jeff Janis's absence, starting with Ty Montgomery, who I'm surprised he even played in the first preseason game after coming off the PUP list just days before. Did he look rusty at all?
I don't think he looked rusty. I think he did a fine job, but he was playing in three wide receiver sets with the one, so he was not only playing but getting playing time with the first unit. And he wasn't asked to do too much. If you just look at his stat line, he only caught one of three passes thrown his way, but the two incompletions were more on Joe Callahan than Montgomery. The catch Montgomery did have was impressive, but really, Montgomery wasn't asked to do too much in this game, but he looked fine in everything that he was asked to do.
That's encouraging for a guy coming off an injury. Next, I'm interested in getting your thoughts on rookie Trevor Davis, who was targeted 5 times but only came away with 2 receptions. Were the incompletions his fault? Were they the quarterback's fault? Or whose fault were they?
Those incompletions, I definitely would say they were not on Davis. The first one is the only one that you could try to make any sort of argument, but it was a deep pass. It was overthrown and well covered, so I wouldn't put that on Davis. The other two, one was a pass batted at the line of scrimmage, so Davis never had a chance to get the ball. And the other one was a pass clearly thrown away by the quarterback. And it was just Davis was the closest receiver to the throw, so the NFL gives him the target. At PFF, we don't even give receiving targets to batted passes, since it's not always clear who the target's supposed to be on those. And then throwaways, we don't give a target because the quarterback's purposely throwing the ball out of bounds and not at a receiver. So by our stats, he caught 2 of 3 passes thrown his way. And of those 2 catches, both of them were nice plays, both third down to first down conversions. But considering he played 43 snaps, you might have wanted to see a little bit more opportunities out of him. But I think Davis did a fine job for what he was given the opportunity to do.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that on the targets and things like that. I think the work Pro Football Focus does definitely is a little bit more attention to detail than the official NFL stats in that regard because of the things you mentioned. But finally here, Jared Abradaris, he saw a lot of playing time when you combine what he did both on special teams and what he did on offense. Do you think this large playtime percentage will continue for Abradaris?
I think it'll probably continue, yeah. He had 33 snaps at wide receiver in the game, another 8 snaps on special teams. In the receiving game, he did a decent job, 2 nice catches for first down, one of them being a screen where it was mostly him doing the work, making a guy miss and ending up with the first down. And then, of course, special teams, he had the one play where he had the punt return weaving in and out of traffic, and that was obviously impressive. But once Cobb and Jordy are back, I'm not sure if Abradaris will still be seeing playing time with the ones. But I definitely expect him to see plenty of playing time throughout the rest of the preseason as the Packers are trying to work out their wide receiver depth chart.
For sure. Nathan, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Looking forward to talking to you every Wednesday here for coming up for at least a majority of the season. So excited to do that. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks again for having me. Talk to you again next week.
Okay. Nathan Yonke making his season debut here at Railbird Central. Glad to have him joining us. Glad to have you, the listener, joining us as well as we continue on with the show.
Packers news of the day.
All right. According to a report originally released by USA Today's Tom Pelissero, who's been on top of this story since the beginning, Packers players Clay Matthews and Julius Peppers, along with former Packer Mike Neal and Pittsburgh Steelers linebacker James Harrison, they will be suspended indefinitely if they don't provide interviews by August 25th in regards to claims made in an Al Jazeera documentary. I'm sure you're familiar with the background by now. Now, believe me, I don't inherently want Matthews and Peppers to be suspended, but I do want to know the truth, and pardon me if I'm skeptical. I've seen Ryan Braun and Alex Rodriguez and Lance Armstrong and many more athletes claim their innocence, you know, in regards to performance-enhancing drugs and then get caught. I've seen this too many times now, so I am skeptical about it. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the legal rights to these players, I get the slippery slope argument that if the players agree to be interviewed now, what happens the next time some unsubstantiated blog makes a claim that a player used drugs? But, you know, here's where I see the difference in this case. All right, I'm going to try to lay this out as much as I can. Number one, whether or not you believe him, Charlie Sly did indeed work in a drug and pharmacy environment. I think that you at least have to take that into account, that indeed happened. You know, he was employed by a pharmacy at one point, and this is not just some guy off the street. Number two, Major League Baseball player Taylor Teagarden was caught on camera admitting to steroid use and has been suspended 80 games by the Major League Baseball. Half a season. No small suspension there. Something the NFLPA never really acknowledges. Maybe it's because it just didn't happen in their league, but it happened in this documentary, which I think, you know, gives it once again, you know, some there's smoke here. Maybe there's not fire, but there's smoke in regards to claims made against other players based upon that. Number three, in a letter from the NFL, and the guy's name is Adolfo Birch, Mike Neal is alleged to have made a false claim about when he was suspended for violating the league's substance abuse policy back in 2012. And I've mentioned this on the show a long time. You know, it's been a few months now since I've mentioned it, but if you're a longtime listener, we've gone over this before. Neal claims he used Adderall, you know, when he was suspended by the NFL in 2012. But, you know, once again, that's just his claim, that this was under the league's old policy when the NFL couldn't correct false claims by players. And you would notice this in a discussion I had with Tom Pelissero on Twitter this morning, if you happen to be following me or him or both of us. So yeah, that you know, raises a red flag in my mind. You know, I don't take Mike Neal's word for it. I just would like to see it confirmed whether it was indeed that he was suspended for Adderall or not. Just because I know this was under the old policy when the league couldn't correct them. And that's why it's been changed. Maybe not this specific case, but it's been changed since that time. You know, since Neal was suspended in 2012, you know, the NFL came out with a more comprehensive, you know, substance abuse policy in which they can correct, you know, if a player lies and says they were suspended for whatever, you know, that the NFL can come out and say, you know, that would indeed be wrong. Furthermore, the fact that Charlie Sly recanted his claims means nothing to me. That means nothing. If you think that alone absolves everything that he said or happened on the documentary, I think you're just naive. Not to say that what he said wasn't true, but you know, the fact, I mean, if you're just going to point that out as evidence and that's all you got, well, that's not enough to me. I mean, he could have said the truth. He could have, and there could have been things that had simply embellished, that had, you know, maybe part of it was true, but he exaggerated or things like that. So there's all sorts of things like that going on. I just want the truth to come out. I've said this many times. I think it's ridiculous that the NFL can't even ask these guys questions. Now, that being said, if you think I'm being too harsh here, I also think there needs to be more evidence than what's currently out there to suspend these players. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But yes, I would be mad if the NFL suspended Clay Matthews and Julius Peppers without outlaying more evidence against them than what's currently available, than what we know, than what was, you know, made in the documentary and what's been reported since that time. You know, I'm sure there's a lot more. There's obviously more to the story we don't know. we weren't there. We weren't present. We don't know these kind of things against any of these players. So there's tons we don't know. And I just wish the truth would come out. So, you know, could there be some sort of court injunction that will make this thing play out even longer? Yes, it's certainly possible. I don't know whether this is going to play out as long as Deflategate. I know everybody hopes that's not the case. But you know, this thing could be another story for beyond August 25th or August 26th. We just have to wait and find out. Ultimately, I don't think anyone will be suspended, like I said, just because of the lack of evidence at this point. But that's all I or anyone can go on at this point. So there you go. There's my thoughts on the PED investigation into Clay Matthews, Julius Peppers, and other players. But other Packers news. Jeff Janis has told media he's going to be out 4 to 6 weeks. And basically, I kind of thought this thing can go four different ways. So I'll try to lay these out as well. Number one, and the most, probably, I think the most improbable outcome would be for the Packers simply to cut Jeff Janis at some point. They certainly can. I mean, they can do it with any player on the roster, hypothetically, at least. So that can happen. Number two, the Packers could put him on season-ending injured reserve, ending any chance of him playing the entire year, just like they did with Jordy Nelson last year, who was on injured reserve the whole entire year. That's number two. Number three, they could place him on the short-term injured reserve. Every team in the NFL gets one and only one player that, gets this designation in which they can come back from injured reserve after, I believe it's 6 weeks to practice and 8 weeks to play in a game, if I remember correctly. I could be wrong about that, but it's in that ballpark at least. So, basically Jeff Janis would miss at least half the season if he were to be placed, get that designation. The Packers, obviously, and every team has to be very choosy about who they, decide to do that with. They've done it with, many players over the course of the years. Andrew Corliss was the player who did last year, who was injured and came back toward the end of the year before getting injured again. What Randall Cobb was that player 1 year. Cedric Benson was that player 1 year. JC Treader, I believe, was that player 1 year. So yeah, a lot of different ways that can play out there. And then finally, the Packers could simply just keep Jeff Janis on the 53-man roster. They say he's going to be out 4 to 6 weeks, and from a timing standpoint, there's still 3 weeks left in the preseason. So that takes up three of them right there. If he's out 4 weeks, maybe he misses the season opener. And if he's on the low end of his recovery and comeback, maybe he's ready by week two of the regular season and healthy by then. Again, that might be optimistic, but I'm just going on this 4 to 6 week window or time frame here. Even if it, lasts, the longer 6 weeks, okay, he's back by week three or week four of the regular season, something like that. You got to remember, the Packers, of course, they keep 53 players on their roster, but it's only a 46-man roster on game days. What is it? Seven players have to be inactive on game days. They have to. So why not Jeff Janis for those first few weeks of the season? Somebody's got to sit out. Seven players got to sit out anyway. So they could go that route as well. So basically, there's four ways Jeff Janis's future can play out here. I really don't have any inclination of which way it's going to play out at this point, other than I think cutting him outright would be, I don't see that happening. I think that would be the least likely. The good news for the Packers is, for the time being, they have 3 weeks to decide. They don't have to make a decision on Jeff Janis right now. They have till they have to cut down to that 53-man roster. They have until then to evaluate his recovery and his progress and make a choice. I guess I can offer this. I wouldn't anticipate Jeff Janis being a heavily used player on offense this year because of this injury. I think he's going to fall behind in the pecking order or behind in the depth chart behind other players. Not to say that they couldn't use him now and again where they might find a spot to utilize his skills. We saw during family night, I thought it was interesting that the Packers ran a designed reverse to Jeff Janis. That could be something they bust out in a game to try to take advantage of his athletic ability. It would be a case in which he didn't have to catch a pass, knowing his hand. Now, I could see, Jeff Janis maybe not playing with a club cast, but if his hand, you know, was impacted by this injury, you know, I could see him playing at 90%, not on offense, but, you know, on special teams, as a kick returner and as a gunner on punts and kickoff team. I could see Jeff Janis, of course, being heavily used in that regard, just like he was last year, and then just playing a minor role on offense as kind of a backup or just kind of a, you know, a utility kind of guy, somebody that they bust out just every once in a blue moon on offense. So, yeah, I wouldn't anticipate Jeff Janis having a heavy role on offense this year. It's unfortunate because I think the injury has, you know, really impacted that. He definitely could have used the, you know, the preseason for more playing time and more experience and everything, especially getting a chance with Aaron Rodgers and probably the third preseason game. But that's not going to be the you know, that's not going to be the case. And we'll see what happens here. At practice, the Packers' last practice on Tuesday, the players that came back from injury were Ty Montgomery and Kyle Murphy. Ty Montgomery apparently was just sitting out for rest the previous day, so nothing to be concerned about there. Just being cautious with him after, you know, being on the, you know, being injured last year, being on the PUP list to start training camp, things like that. And he, like we talked about with Nathan Yonke, looked very good in the first exhibition game. As for Kyle Murphy, I thought that was great to see him finally come back from a concussion that's kept him out the early portion of training camp. He's missed more time than he's practiced so far. And for all the depth issues the Packers have been having on the offensive line, it's a welcome addition to their offensive line because, you know, once again, obviously, you don't want to see the first string offensive line playing much. You know, in that first preseason game, they played a series, basically. I don't want to see them playing much the second preseason game. I want to see the second and third string offensive line get a lot of playing time, get a lot of snaps. So hopefully Kyle Murphy gets a lot of experience, and you know, everybody on those second and third string units. There was barely a third string offensive line in the first preseason game because they were so banged up with so many players out, with Murphy and Matt Rotherham and Josh James all sitting out. But hopefully they're a little bit more healthy here after signing Kyle Stuck as well earlier in the week. So there's that. And then finally, the Packers paid $3 million to host the Wisconsin versus LSU college football game, according to the Green Bay Press Gazette. Just kind of interesting how much the Packers had to pay, but as the saying goes, you have to spend money to make money. And that is definitely the case here. You know, they're not just playing, these teams aren't just playing for free at Lambeau Field. The Packers had to pay them, but in return, the Packers are also keeping ticket sales, they're keeping concessions, they're keeping parking, they're selling merchandise at the game. So they will be making easily more than the $3 million investment they made into the game. And that's coming up now in just about, a little over 2 weeks. This Wisconsin-LSU is going to be played at Lambeau Field. I'm going to be there. I'm really excited to see a college football game at the professional, you know, the professional stadium that perhaps most closely resembles the college environment in a place like Green Bay. I'm really excited for that. So that should be fun. But that leads us into the next segment.
The day ahead.
On Wednesday, the Green Bay Packers are practicing behind closed doors today. So don't expect to go to training camp and see the Packers practice in Green Bay today. It's not going to happen. They're probably going to practice inside the Don Hutson Center, in which they'll close the doors. And again, this is standard operating procedure the day before any game. The Packers just, you know, they want to keep things, their game plans a little bit secret and don't want anybody seeing them. Which is understandable, and they just like to keep, I think, their players focused don't need any distractions, things like that. So multiple reasons they do this. There will be more chances to watch them in training camp coming up. And then, of course, the Packers host the Oakland Raiders on Thursday at 7 o'clock p.m. Central Time, the kickoff. Reminding folks, once again, if you live in the Green Bay and Milwaukee markets, you're not going to see the game on the NBC affiliates as scheduled. This will be a situation where the NBC has the rights to show the Olympics, so they're going to show them, and thus the game will be played. You just got to look for it on those on other stations. I think it's WACY in Green Bay, WMLW, I believe, in Milwaukee. Make sure to check your local listings if you're in the state and want to watch the game. Just because it may not be where you expect it to be. It will be televised, just maybe not where you expect. This one isn't nationally televised. You could stream it, but you're going to have to buy the NFL's Game Pass if you want to do that. So you may be interested in doing so. But looking forward to it, because I think this is going to be Brett Hundley's preseason debut. This weekend, or at least in 2016. We saw plenty of him in 2015. I've yet to see him in 2016 in a game environment, and excited to do so. Excited to see him get a nice long look here, because perhaps don't expect Aaron Rodgers to play at all. So Brett Hundley could use the work for sure, being the backup and number two quarterback this year. He needs to learn how to operate the Packers offense and get it going, and hope to see as much success from him as we did last year in the exhibition slate. But that'll do it for today's episode of Railbird Central. Thank you, everybody, so much for joining us today. Thank you to Nathan Yonke of ProFootballFocus.com for joining us. Already got our guest for Friday lined up. We're going to talk to Justin Garcia of the Packers Radio Network. He's going to be talking to us the morning after he works, so we'll find out what his job entails with the Packers Radio Network, as well as kind of react to what happened on the field in the Raiders game and the storylines that emerge from there. So enjoy the game, folks. We'll talk to you again on Friday. Railbird Central airs every Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 8:30 a.m. Central Time, which is the live edition of the show at cheeseheadtv.com. Podcasted and on demand later in the day. My call to action, as always, as usual, if you've not done so already, please give us a rating and review on iTunes, because this show is free of charge, no subscription, no paywall. So if you could do us a solid, go to iTunes, search Cheesehead TV, it'll pop right up. Give us that 5-star rating and a brief little review. And that's all we ask, because it helps us get word out about the show. In fact, we're at, last I looked, 199 ratings, almost at that 200 benchmark. So would really like to get there. Thanks, folks. Like I said, enjoy the game. We'll talk to you again in just 2 days from now. On behalf of everybody at Cheesehead TV, I'm Brian Caribou. We will see you later. I leave you today with a song called The Surf by Lotus on Psy Fidelity Records. Go Pack, go.